Love Talk Radio.
Episode we have here, Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. We are back for a week off last weekend, but we are back in a big way because we got two shows today. The first show we're going to have coming up here is author H.T. Nerera. He is the author of The Fund, which just came out May 10th. The next author we're having up for you on this show is going to be best-selling author Dale Brown, coming out with his latest book, A Time for Patriots. And then further on down the day, we had to kind of work around his schedule. But 3 o'clock Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time, we're going to have best-selling author Steve Barry on the phone to talk about the Jefferson Key and his latest Cotton Malone mystery series. So you guys have a lot to look forward to and a lot of other announcements and things coming up because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Thank everybody for joining us this Saturday morning here. We have on Suspense Radio a great show for you. We are going to get to our first guest, H.T. Nerera, in about 30 seconds. So I just want to remind everybody again that at 3 o'clock today, we are having another show for about 45 minutes. We're going to have Steve Barry on, along with we are going to be putting out the first chapter of Andrew Peterson's Forced to Kill. It's actually going to be in audio form. You'll be able to hear that right here exclusively on Suspense Radio coming up at about 3:30 after Steve Barry is on. And then May 26th, mark your calendars, 2 p.m. Pacific time. That's a Thursday. We are having Laurel K. Hamilton on to talk about her Anita Blake series coming out, Hit List, the latest book there. So a lot of things going on. But right now we want to get to our first guest. We want to thank him so much for coming on. It's H.T. Nerera, the author of The Fund, which came out May the 10th. It is a financial terroristic book, and with all the stuff going on that just happened a couple weeks ago, as you might know, with the death of Bin Laden, there's no better time for these things to come out. So, H.T., I want to thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I am doing great, John. Thank you for having me on here and with such a packed schedule.
Yeah, we are. We got packed. See, we took a week off, and then we kind of packed everything because then we got stuff going on next Saturday, and, yeah, we're loaded,
sounds
which is a good thing. Happens
good
in the summer.
And good shows coming up. That's great.
Yeah, so you're an international investment banker, and you wrote a book called The Fund, which has to do a lot with, you know, financial terrorism and things that can happen besides, you know, just guns and things. Can you kind of explain a little bit about The Fund and how that kind of, you know, worked into your head that you had to, that you wanted to get this story out here?
Absolutely. First of all, yes, I am a banker, but don't hold that against me, okay, John?
I was looking to say something. I'm like, lawyers and bankers, huh? The two things I like
really
to get on the air.
At the bottom of the heap, yeah. Well, first of all, my father-in-law was a novelist. He actually invented a genre he called financial fiction. His name was Paul Erdman, and he had a lot of number one New York Times bestsellers there in the early 80s, late 70s. And I helped him at a certain point in time research and edit some of those books. So I had a first-hand knowledge of, you know, what goes into something like this. So that's probably where the impetus for this came through. The second of it is the fact that I looked around the universe of banking and certainly the things that have happened in the last few years, and we can all probably agree that the way the system is set up in financial markets, we've seen a little bit of this happen. We don't need to know the details of it, but we certainly see the headline. Basically, yep. The system, how it's set up, is that people, legitimate players in the market, go out there and for a profit gain, which are, part of the capitalist system, go out and make money, and in the process probably bring down a company or two in terms of the things that they do in terms of hedge funds and derivative activities and the like. And so I looked at that and said, well, what if somebody who were not maybe necessarily just interested in profits, but rather was more interested in a political motive, decided to do this? And so that gave me the premise to start to look at someone going out there and saying, I have a motive of terrorism, maybe not kinetic, just blowing up something, but rather having an impact way beyond a bomb somewhere, but rather something that really hits home, in certainly in the U.S. space, which is our economy and the livelihood that people depend on financial markets. And so that gave me the premise of this book, saying these people that, when you look at people like Bin Laden and others, others that either have been killed or sitting in Gitmo in prison, those are kind of the swashbucklers of that movement. But, what people now are concerned about in Washington, at least in the intelligence circles, are what they call, quote-unquote, the men in the gray suits. In other words, those people that are more hidden, they're very deep in they may be sitting in our economy right now, and we don't know what they're up to and what they're trying to do. And my book is really about one of those types, moving into the next generation of terrorism, in a sense. No, not just going in and having a backpack with a bomb, but rather having a broader impact in a more sophisticated way.
Right. It's more of the terrorism, the scary part of what you can't see, but what you're going to feel, which is kind of since 2008 what America has been feeling, and now Greece and other countries in Europe, they're kind of feeling that economic demise is more scary because it's unknown than just a bomb going off in the middle of a town square, because it goes off, yes, people die, but then it's over in an instant, where this continues to keep going.
Right. This has a broader systemic impact. Now, the challenge of this, and this is certainly something I learned from my father-in-law, is that, having a background in finance and economics, and I can go on and write something like this and write it in a nonfiction format, and probably 10 people will read it. But what I decided to do is write it in a novel form to make it more broadly accessible. So the biggest compliment I get from people that have started reading this is they say, they come back to me and say, I never in a million years would have thought this would be the type of book that I like, which is a financial fiction and the like. And it comes back to them and says, I really enjoyed it, and I didn't stop to have to think about any of the things that were in there. It seeps in enough information, but there's no quiz at the end, let's put it that way.
And I want to remind everybody, this is H.T. Narera. Your website is H.T. Narera, NARREA.com, to find out a lot more information. And the one thing we're going to go is you'll be able to read an excerpt of the book, The Fund, which came out May 10th. And they're able to get a little bit about your new character, because this is your debut book.
Correct.
And so this is your newest character. You're kind of throwing her out there. And yeah. I'm going to guess here her name is Kate Morales.
Kate Morales.
See, I'm terrible with last names. I told you that off the air. I try to guess, and I'm not very good.
It's okay, John Rob. It's okay. I practice theory. She is a defense intelligence analyst, and she works in Washington. Had a former career. In her case, she was a trader at Bear Stearns at a point in time, and then decided to, when that thing went under, she decided to go into Washington and go into intelligence, and figured as she started going into it, she really loved it, and this is really where her career is going to be. The thing about her that's interesting is she ends up chasing something that she starts seeing up on a screen of some funny transfers of money that goes to some odd places, and she ends up being really the only one that kind of pursues it in a serious way. People are occupied with other things in intelligence at that point in time, and she's the one really that kind of breaks the code of the whole thing, and after traveling for a few places around the world, in Latin America, certainly New York, and Europe, and through that she ends up finding perpetrators and some plot going on, and we'll leave it to the readers to figure out what happens next. But the point of it is, for her is that she is a woman, and that, you know, there's women that do important things in places like Washington, and I wanted to display that in terms of the character set. I enjoyed getting in her head. I am surrounded by women in my home. I have a very smart and intelligent wife, smarter than I am, and I have two very intelligent young women, teenagers, who teach me a great deal about what women are challenged by in today's world.
Your household sounds like mine. I'm surrounded by women, too, and, in fact, I have two female cats, so I have no males in the house. So we're together in that one.
Okay. So you get where I'm coming from, yeah,
I do, and I'm at the bottom of the totem pole, so I always know that. Now, my other question is, you know, in interviewing Brad Thor and Brad Metzler and Vince Flynn and a lot of other people that are, you know, do a lot of, you know, behind-the-scenes government things, and they do a lot of research, the government, you know, pretty much they have to send their work almost to these agencies to say, am I allowed to use this or talk about it, because some things that are mentioned in the book, maybe America should not know, and they say, no, you can, or yes, you can, and this and that. Did you have to kind of go through the same thing when you're discussing something so sensitive in the fact that it can almost be done?
Yeah, I went through a little bit. I have a lot of people that I know in government, certainly in the financial sector and the financial side of government, and I did do a little bit of touch and feel on that stuff in sensitive areas. And certainly even in the private sector, you have those issues as well. I have had a long career at J.P. Morgan Chase, and so I had to also, you know, be careful in things that come out there. But at the end of the day, this is my story. It is fiction, though obviously given my experience, you can probably see there's a directional of truth in this. What I found most amazing, and it astounded even me, John, is that about 2 months ago, my editor sent me a newspaper article, something that came out in Washington, and it turns out there was some report that was commissioned by the Department of Defense about something they termed economic warfare and financial terrorism. And you know, from even just looking at the jacket theme of my book, that my book deals with something I call financial terrorism. So through my friends, I got a copy of that report, and I read it. I started reading it, and honestly, I went through it. Probably 90% of that report paralleled my book. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what was my reaction. I was like, whoa, this is crazy. So I got a hold of the guy that wrote that report, and we sat down for a nice long lunch to turn it into an early dinner in Washington about a month ago. I had given him my book in the meantime. He had read it, and he equally had that feeling like, whoa. That's amazing, because even when he was doing the research, he said, wow, some of this stuff, it could make a great novel. And there it was. Mm-hmm. The novel had been written. So we independently of each other, he did his, you know, real-life, you know, nonfiction report for the commission by the Department of Defense, and I wrote my novel. And they parallel each other in terms of the things that they touched, the issues they raised in terms of the dangers that we face, the risks that we're facing our economy today at about a 90% level, down to details that were just uncanny. And that, you know, obviously shocked him a little bit. We ended up, Georgetown was kind enough, the university, about 2 weeks ago, we hosted a panel discussion there with academics and people from the intelligence community and government regulators. We sat down and we compared the two books, you know, in the sense, here's a fiction story, here's a nonfiction. And what comes out often, and certainly in many countries around the world, is that fiction often reflects reality more closely than people can imagine in terms of what's out there. And in certain countries where maybe there's a lot of restriction on nonfiction sources, that fiction is the place where you end up more of the truth than in the nonfiction side. So I think it's certainly in my case, my book, you know, it turns out that there's concerns within defense intelligence community about some of these issues. And so there's a definite amount of truth in this. And I think what people have to be aware of is that these issues that come out in the book, when Defense Department gets involved in something, it's in another area of concern. If you look at the SEC or the Treasury Department or the New York Fed, when they're getting involved in all these financial issues and concerns about regulating markets more, it's a question of regulating a market, making sure there's no more, you know, Madoff schemes and the like coming up. When the Defense Department gets involved in things, they're really dealing on issues of national security. It's a whole other realm. It's a whole other ball of wax, that we like to say. So my book brings kind of the two together, one on the kind of the financial side and how to control these markets and the questions that are in front of Congress just now and discussing that right now, And then on the other side is issues of national security. What's the next generation of terrorism? It's no longer just guys with guns and, you know, bombs. It's really, there's another more sophistication that will evolve. And that's what people are really focusing on now and concerned about.
And, you know, and that's kind of the deep, you know, that thrillers are supposed to do. It's the deep emotional connection that you have to get with, you know, with readers. I mean, because you're putting a lot of things on them, but it's still a fiction story. It's still, you know, it's about your character, Kate, and, you know, about who you are, you know, as a writer. And so when you were writing this and you were putting it out there, did you ever have any concerns that you were kind of, you know, getting away from the thriller sense and putting it a little bit into more of the financial that people might not? Because since financial terrorism is still kind of very new and there's nothing really out there, a lot of readers might not really understand what it is, and, you know, you kind of have to break
right.
it down because,
right.
you know, you're an
right.
investment banker. You could put words and things in there, and people are like, what is he talking about? Because I
yeah.
have no clue.
Yeah.
You know what I know about the bank? I put my check in, and that's what I know. So do you
well,
have – so did you have
I,
to
I
take
– No, that was a definite – that was an excellent question, John, because it is an issue for someone in my genre to write about it. It's got to
yeah.
be – accessible enough for people, and on the side, I also teach at Georgetown Finance, and so I understand this thing about you have to take a new concept and try to get it to an explainable position. So let's think about derivatives for a second, and there's a central component here about derivatives, and the reason is because I, as others have looked at in the past, looked at derivatives being financial weapons of mass destruction. That's kind of a basic premise here. But most people don't really understand what a derivative is, and I'm certainly not going to sit there and try to explain, here's how to write one and the whole big long formula to do it, but rather explain how and the dangers that exist in them. And the way I end up describing it for people, what the danger is of them, there are a bunch of these financial instruments, and they really, at the end of the day, resemble the whole market of this resembles like a big bowl of tangled spaghetti. And that's the problem.
Okay.
And people cannot untangle them. And people cannot understand what one end of it yield goes to the other end. Who's holding each end of those things? And that's the struggle that people have with these instruments, and they're trying to get them clarified, and they're trying to get them into these central exchanges so there's more clarity to understand who holds both ends of these little financial contracts so we know who's holding the dangerous side of them. And right now, they're still in a tangled web of this, you know, spaghetti sitting in a bowl, and you can't really figure out who's holding what end. And that's the problem. So that is the extent you all need to know for the storyline to know about derivatives. Now, if you want to know more about it, certainly you can go off to 1,000 places and figure out exactly how to create a derivative and how to write it and stuff, but it's not necessary for this storyline to know that.
Right. Now, here's the other thing. Your first book, you're putting out there, you have no idea what's going to happen. What was your biggest fear before the book was released here, the fund, we're talking to H.T. Narera, but the book was released on May 10th. What was your biggest fear before the book came out?
You know, I didn't really have any. I haven't been focused on writing in that sense. It's not something that I said, you know, I'm going to do this the last 20 years. It's something that happened. It's very serendipitous the way it happened. A storyline came into my mind. I got very... very you know, strict about how to outline it and how to do a little bit every day as I did my day job, and I managed to get it done. And then I was very fortunate in the way a couple of people saw it, and I landed a frankly probably impossible agent, Lynn Nesbitt, who you know, at this point wasn't taking any clients on, but she read the book and loved it. To my surprise and shock, you know, I came in as a debut author not expecting much. I didn't, you know, I have low expectations generally in terms of that's how I am, a conservative person. And so, you know, if it happened, it happened. But it was like, it was tremendous for reaction to it. And then it was even more fortunate in terms of a publisher she found for me, because they had, in fact, edited my father-in-law's book, several of them. So they understood this genre very well. They could immediately jump on it and fashion it in the right way and position it in the right way. But I felt very confident in the way they were handling it. So I'm actually just lucky, because I know it's a very difficult business.
And then the other thing with, you know, with Bin Laden just dying and now, you know, having you on here and now having Dale Brown coming on, who's a big political thriller, that has to escalate people's interest again in what's going on, and that actually gives you a big boost. And it's almost like, wow,
it's
you know,
like
thanks
you
for
think,
dying, Bin
like
Laden. I appreciate it.
It's almost like it makes you think that my publisher had something to do with finding him, right?
Exactly. Kill him. We got to sell books.
Yeah, like
and, you know,
last,
I'm not
going to
put my anything by nobody anymore. I just have no idea. I'm not putting nothing by nobody.
It certainly, obviously, we're all, you know, very pleased that that occurred in general in our country. But the positioning of this book and the attention that the book is getting because of those issues that come out in there, absolutely. I mean, I have scenes in my book that are scenes in the Situation Room where you know, the president and his staff are looking in a scene of people swooping in somewhere. I have those kind of, and not finding him in a cave at the end of the day, not these terrorist leaders. So it is, there are a lot of parallels that I've been seeing from my book and what we're experiencing. So it's uncanny in that sense, the predictive nature a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, they're looking for Bin Laden, like in New York City, and he was living in Jersey the whole time, and that's kind of like where it was. I was just kind of laughing.
Now,
your publisher, now, I don't know, how many book deals did they sign you to? Was it two, three?
Two.
Okay, so now, for your second book, is Kate coming back, or is it going to be a standalone? What are you doing here in the future? Because now
you've got to
start writing.
Yeah, no, I'm already at work on what is a sequel to this book. So yes, Kate is
Kate
alive
will be back.
And well.
Okay.
Yeah. I picture her actually, you know, a lot of like, you know, she's like the female Bourne in a sense at the end of the day.
Oh, female Jason Bourne. Hmm.
Right.
Interesting spin. That's good because then people can relate to the character, so they know, you know, how she's going to be and who she's going to be, which is extremely important,
right?
Because people need that emotional connection, whether it's love or hate, to your character. That's what drives them back, along with
the
story.
Yeah, she goes through, you know, she experiences a lot of things that any normal human would experience, and you see that coming out in the book, and that's important. And frankly, those were some of the best aspects I enjoyed doing it. The whole process of writing for me was tremendous. A tremendous discovery. I enjoyed doing that every day. It was kind of like yoga for me every morning, early in the morning, writing those pages. And so I very much enjoyed getting in her head. And I also enjoyed getting in the head of what I'd say is probably the antagonist in the story, in the BB, who is this guy who's planning some nasty things to happen to the world. But the thing about him is that since, you know, no one is totally evil and no one is totally good, the thing about my antagonist is that by the end, you probably see him as a more human person as opposed to just one-dimensionally evil, and you begin to understand some of the things that he has embarked upon, and maybe there's a little twinge of, you know, maybe a little bit of character arc there that humanizes him a little bit more than you would have expected at the very beginning.
So I have a question here, too. I'm kind of starting to ask authors this because I'm curious to see how their reaction is. But let's say that you have Kate sitting in front of you right now, and you're looking at her. What's one question you want to ask her? What's one thing you want to know from your character?
I have it in my mind for her that she has a career in, like, a Jack Ryan, actually. And so I picture her eventually becoming the first female president. So my question to her is: Do you have the verb? Do you have the guts to eventually run for that office? That would be my question for her.
And is that something that you're going to challenge her in future books? Then I take it. So you're going to challenge that question in future books.
I have a 30-year trajectory for her already in mind. For her career. Yeah. She's in her late 20s, but I'm picturing her at future stages already, and I can see her evolving into those roles. Yeah.
So we can definitely expect a lot more from Kate coming here in the future and her expanding role into whatever we're going to see, but she's going to be, you know, around for quite some time, which is good.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing as a vehicle, you know, the interesting thing is because we can see now, we can have discussions about the challenges that our country has, let's say, in the next decade, in the next 20 years, the next 30 years, that some of the things that will be happening in not only economic terms, political terms, national security terms, technology terms even, that she can be part of that storyline that I see of these things that are, you know, part of the process and the history that we can foresee for our country, some of the avenues that can occur and alternative realities that can occur for us as a country and the challenges that we'll see out in the world. So we're going through interesting times, and I think that the fiction forum is a great place to have those kind of discussions and get people engaged in that discussion as opposed to, you know, writing an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, which I love, but again, it has a more limited reach than does novels.
Well, again, H.C. Nerera is who we're talking to here. The book is The Fund. It has been out since May the 10th. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you find it, e-readers. And it is in print.
It's on every e-reader.
You'll
find it.
Wherever you need it.
And otherwise, if you can't somehow find it, just go to my website, htnerea.com.
Narea.com. And you want to, so let's wrap up here and let's tell everybody a little bit about what kind of tour you're going on or where people might be able to meet you at. Can they contact you on your website and things like that?
They can definitely contact me on my website, and then I look forward to hearing from them. I'm on Twitter, Author Narea. I'm on Facebook, also HT Narea. You can find all those links on my website. In terms of tour, we've had several events in Connecticut and in New York. We've had an event in Washington. We're going to have an event in Miami, Chicago, San Francisco, and another one. Actually, the most next one that we have is an event at the Mysterious Bookshop in Manhattan. That should be coming up in June, followed by the one in Miami at Books and Books. So we're planning a lot. If people want to attend any of these, you just got to go on the website and send me a little blip there, and I'll make sure they get the details, and I hope to see them in person.
Well, there we go. All right, HT, it has been fabulous talking to you. Nothing but wonderful success with your book here, The Fund, and your Into the Future, and we want to stay in touch to see what's coming out. Because we want to follow Kate and, you know, the career of what's going to go on and see what happens here. So stay in touch with us.
Thank you, John, for having me.
All right. You have a good day.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, bye. So, again, everybody, that was H.T. Nerera, and the book is The Fund. You can find him at htnarea.com. His book is out now. So now we're going to go over and bring on our next guest, switch the little gears. We are coming to visit with Dale Brown. His book is A Time for Patriots. Dale is widely successful here in the political spy books. A Time for Patriots is another one that just, you know, hard-hitting right there in the realm with his character, Patrick McCallahan. So, Dale, I want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, John. How are you doing today?
We're doing good. I mean, Southern California, nice, sunny, weather's getting better, so can't complain about that at all.
Yeah, we finally got a break here up in Lake Tahoe. We've been having very cold and snowy conditions here for the past couple of weeks, and now today the sun's finally come out, so we're getting a break.
Yeah, that's always a good thing because, you know, tired of all the – but we do thank you for the snow because that's how we get our water down here. So we do thank you for that. So Time for Patriots just came out or is just coming out because it just says May 2011, didn't have a definitive date. But it is your latest book here with Air Force Lieutenant General, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Patrick McCallahan. And can you tell us a little bit about what's going on? Because right now, you know, like we were just talking, that the country is so enthralled with the death of Bin Laden and everything terrorism that your book couldn't have come out at a better time.
Well, this is more, it's not so much of an international geopolitical thriller that I usually do. It's not vast armadas of supersonic bombers and space planes and things like that. This one, Patrick McClanahan is retired. He's a retired three-star general. He has chosen to take his son to a north central Nevada, where the reader will soon find out exactly why he did that. But he's in a small town called Battle Mountain. He's a flight instructor, and he's a member of the Civil Air Patrol, which is the U.S. Air Force auxiliary, and they do missions, mostly search and rescue missions for the U.S. Air Force. And from there, the financial situation in the United States has gotten worse. There's been a double dip recession. Times are tough. So the new U.S. president has decided to respond to the economic downturn by slashing taxes and by slashing government services. So
right.
He's really reduced the government and he's reduced the burden on the government. But at the same time, excuse me. Good grief.
I understand. See, and what I find so fascinating is because I'm going to let you know, because my dad is he's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and he was a navigator. And so always used to tell me a lot of great stories about the Air Force and about the military and things like that. So stories like yours always captured my attention because I'd like to see you put such realism in, because you're a retired Air Force captain. So the realism that you put into your stories is like none other, which different from someone who's never been in the military and trying to write about the military. It just doesn't quite have that same, thriller punch that you're able to put in.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much, John. As I was saying, I still draw on my Air Force background for this one, but what I've also done in the past year and a half or so is I joined the Civil Air Patrol, and I'm a mission pilot, a mission search pilot for the Civil Air Patrol. But back to the story, with the severe economic downturn, there are fewer services available for people, so a lot of folks in a lot of communities believe that the government has abandoned them. So they sort of band together into domestic sort of survivalist type communities, and some of them are extreme survivalists where they go to more towards the militants. And they not only do they want to band together themselves and separate themselves from the government, they want to keep the government out of their community, and they're willing to use violence to do it. So the response to these homegrown terrorists is Patrick McClanahan and his son Bradley now want to sort of turn their Civil Air Patrol squadron into a high-tech surveillance unit to try to track down and stop these terrorists. And that's what the book is about. But what I also try to explore in the book is the idea of patriotism and volunteerism and returning to the community, which cuts both ways. That could be the good guys and the bad guys. And what I really wanted to give to the reader in this book is to blur the lines between the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys do things that could be considered terrorism, while the bad guys are doing things that could be considered defending their community and their neighbors and their way of life. So I really wanted to confuse the reader a little bit, hopefully entertainingly, but I wanted to sort of blur the lines between the good guys and the bad guys in this book.
And I think that we've all in the news heard of these militia groups, and a lot of them maybe don't understand because the media puts a terrible spin on what they do. And like you say, a lot of them were loyal patriots that have just been abandoned, and now this is their only way of showing their patriotism or who they are in kind of an odd way, but a way that they think is correct.
Right, exactly.
And I think that kind of gets confusing to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, that's one of the main themes I wanted to explore in this book, and I wanted to show how the government response might be to these militia groups, and how the community might respond to these community groups, and who is the more hard-handed with this, who really cares about their community, and who really doesn't care about the community. That was one of the major themes. And the other major theme in the book that I wanted to explore was Bradley McClanahan. Patrick is kind of getting up there in age.
Son.
Right, exactly. And he just comes of age. He's 17, just turning 18, and he's actually had a very sheltered life. He's living under the shadows of his famous father, and now here in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, they're almost equals. He's trying to find himself. Actually, Patrick's trying to find himself now that he's no longer in the Air Force. So it's sort of a exploratory time for both of them, and they're both trying to figure out exactly who they are and what they want to be for the next next 5, 10, 15, 50 years. So that's another thing that I really wanted to start in the book. I'm not sure. Well, I didn't really want to answer it in this book. I want to keep the questions and keep the explorations coming in the next few years. But that's what I really wanted to pick up. But not necessarily just to create a new cast of characters, but to take Bradley's character. One thing I wasn't able to do with Patrick's character. Patrick started the series of books as an Air Force captain, and he was already kind of established. But Bradley's fairly new in the books. He's been in one or two of the other ones, but not really as a major character. And this is where he finally steps forward and starts to become a major character. And you can try to guess or try to see where I want to go with him. And it's not necessarily following in his father's footsteps. So this is where I start to build on his character and have a little fun with him, too, at the same time.
Right, because, I mean, a lot of people don't know. I mean, Patrick has gone as far back as, like, 1987 when you had him in Flight of the Old Dog.
Exactly,
and,
right.
You know, and now all of a sudden we're here in 2011, and now it's time for his son to maybe start, you know, coming out and stepping out. And I was wondering, do you get more fan mail about books that you have set specifically in the United States more than books that are set or handle with other countries? Do you kind of get a little bit more reaction to that because it is a little closer to home? Because sometimes when you read a thriller book and things are set in Russia or, you know, China and Iraq and Iran, it's great reads and people love to read them. But then all of a sudden when you're talking about America and right here in your own backyard, it kind of gets people a little bit more emotional. Do you feel that way too?
Well, I think I've got several groups of readers out there. I think most of the readers really like the ones set overseas. They like to see the great big sweeping strategic type stories where it's a relatively small cast of characters, but it's a really focused objective that the characters have in a very specific part of the world, and they like to get the background stuff. When I first started writing, there was no doubt in anybody's mind who the bad guy was. You know, it was the Soviet
right.
Union, so you really didn't have to build in the background of why the United States and the Soviet Union are fighting each other and where this Cold War come from. But I think a lot of my readers, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and then I picked different adversaries, you really had to kind of explain why we're fighting those guys. You know, why are we fighting in Ukraine, or why are we fighting in Belarus, or why are we fighting in Lithuania? You know what?
Right.
So I think a lot of the readers like that background stuff, and I think a lot of those readers are a little uncomfortable with me writing about downtown Sacramento or writing about terrorist attacks in Washington, D.C. So I think I've got two groups of characters. Now, the ones I have set in the U.S., like the Tin Man, books like that, those books, and I think like A Time for Patriots, which so far is doing pretty well out there, I think that second group of readers really enjoys that, and they like, especially the ones that live in the area, they actually get to see their intersections, and they get to see the county seat that's been attacked, and they can actually see the control tower at Reno Tahoe International Airport, and they can envision the terrorists buzzing the tower on their way to the target. So I like writing stories that both those groups can identify with. I think I'm still going to go back to the international strategic geopolitical stories, but it was a lot of fun doing this book again, keeping a nice small cast of characters with a very limited objective. It's just that this one doesn't involve several continents and aircraft flying for thousands of miles.
And so I'll remind everybody, we're speaking here with bestselling author Dale Brown. The book is A Time for Patriots. It just came out here May 2011. And that's one thing that we can always count on is either May or June, we're going to have a new Dale Brown book, because that's the way it's been here, you know, for the last 10, 11 years. Is May or June, we're having a new Dale Brown book coming out. And that's great that your publisher's been able to leave it that way. And your website is called megafortress.com. So I want to remember it's megafortress.com. It's not your name, so people can go there and see, because you have all of your books listed and the synopsises and everything else that you have going on, with a lot of great information, and people can keep up with it, because you've also kind of written the series with Patrick that they don't have to go all the way back to the beginning. You know, we're talking, you know, 20-some years ago. You can kind of jump right in here with A Time for Patriots, because you're introducing Bradley and those types of things, and you're still getting a good sense, and then you can kind of go back and reinvent and re-see, you know, the beginning, which is great.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I always recommend to people who ask me which book should I start with, and I always tell them the very same thing, John, that you don't have to start with any particular book. I always recommend that they get a copy of Flight of the Old Dog. That was the first one that sets up the cast of characters that I've mostly used throughout the series of books. Now I've had the pleasure and the displeasure of killing off a lot of those original characters, and some fans aren't really happy with that, the way I do that. But I always recommend Flight of the Old Dog as the first one, and that sort of identifies my style. I'll be the first one to admit to everybody that in the early books, especially Flight of the Old Dog, that the main character wasn't a human being, it was a machine. And that was true, I guess, I guess it's still true. It's I really like the technology. I like to keep it technical. So they are very, very technical. Not as technical as that first draft of Flight of the Old Dog was, where every switch and every circuit breaker and every instrument that you needed to release a weapon out of a B-52, I would describe in there. You know, and the agents and the publishers wanted to tone that down a little bit, but they realized that there was a different voice that was emerging out there. Sort of like the Stephen Koons and Tom Clancy type of guys, where the technology was still in there, the story still flowed, and the characters still emerged and they changed and morphed, but at the same time, all that the hardware and the technology and the geopolitical stuff was still in there, and a lot of readers, especially us guy readers, really yeah. liked that stuff. And so I'm the first one to admit that mine are plot-based, they're not character-based. I think I'm getting better over the years, but I think they'll always be really, really based on the plot and the characters react to the plot and not the other way around.
And, you know, going back all that, I mean, you're talking back in the Cold War when you were writing the draft, because that's when the Soviet Union, the United States, everybody was worried that nuclear war was going to come out. You know, they hadn't tore anything down yet when you had to bring out Fly the Old Dog. So that had to be, you know, when you kind of go back 24 years ago, that had to be a little bit, you know, different than it is today, because you had so many, I guess you had a lot more different kind of tension in the world than you do now, where it's kind of difficult to try to stay current. Like you went with Executive Intent, you know, you had to do with Somalian pirates and things like that. Where now it just makes it a little bit more difficult, I believe, from back then to now, to kind of keep going forward.
Sure. Yeah, you're exactly right. You had to, it was relatively easy back then because you didn't have to define who the bad guys were. You know, everybody
right.
knew who the bad guys were. And then you just had to get into the story, and everybody, now the downside of that would be that everybody kind of knew who was going to win. I mean, especially with these types of books, I mean, everybody expected the good guys to win. Now, you don't want to make that obvious to anybody, but still, that's what your readers expect. You expect to have the good guys and the bad guys, and they expect a good fight, and they want some wins and losses, but eventually they want the good guys to win. And that was, in those days, that was expected. The good guys would always win. You had to change that after a while. You know, the Russians, especially in the 90s, weren't necessarily any sort of adversary. So you sort of had to search around for bad guys who could stand up to the last and the only world superpower. So if you're writing military novels and you want to have an adversary that's worthy of the United States, you really had to build one. You really couldn't assume that the readers would recognize the bad guy right away. You actually had to build the adversary, and you had to build the situation where the United States would get into the fight in the first place. So it's more challenging to write them, but but at the same time, it's a lot more fulfilling. The using current day geopolitical issues and using current day or maybe a little bit of futuristic military hardware, and then building a story from there. And that's why I love doing it. You know, I remind myself, or I recognize every day how lucky I am to live in a place like Lake Tahoe and be able to write books all the time. It's great.
And, you know, when we're thinking back, I think that the Oklahoma City bombing changed a lot of things because it was right here homegrown and it happened in Oklahoma City. And then, of course, 9/11 took it to another level where all of a sudden it was stuff that we had never seen in our lifetime before because we'd never, ever been since, you know, I guess you want to say the Revolutionary War, as another country ever been able to come over here and, you know, take us on our soil. And so aside from World War II and over Hawaii, the continental United States, nothing ever happened to. And that just shocked the very foundation of, you know, how we live, and it changed everything forever. And I think that, you know, by having to write these things in your books like you did here with, you know, A Time for Patriots, almost having to not really identify the bad guys, because it's kind of tough to identify them sometimes.
Right. Well, you're right about Oklahoma City and about 9/11. You know, that really did break down a lot of barriers that a lot of us writers had about exactly how far could you go to surprise or even horrify your readers. I mean, could you actually describe thousands of people getting killed? You know, Plan of Attack was one of my first novels after 9/11, and I have a nuclear attack against the United States. Well, I killed several thousand people, several thousand Americans in that story with nuclear cruise missiles. But after 9/11, it didn't. I think before 9/11, I could never have done that. You know, nobody would believe it. And if you did pick up the book and read it, if you weren't so horrified that you just put it down immediately, you just wouldn't believe it. I mean, something like this could never happen. But then after 9/11, everything changed, and now almost anything was possible. So it was a different type of job for the guys like me who write those types of book. But then a lot of barriers were removed then, and you could sort of expand your horizons a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, those things happened to where, you know, it kind of did open up, you know, array of many different political and spy thrillers, and spawned, you know, shows like 24 to push the limits of people, and they even had to maybe not know if they were going to bring out the second season of 24 because of what it was right after, you know, 9/11 happened. So
it definitely was
a changer. Now, a lot of people are always going to ask, is that the biggest question I'm sure that a lot of that we get, and maybe that you get after they read A Time for Patriots, they want to know what's coming up next for your next book. And we know it's probably going to be out in May. But what do you got planned?
Well, I'm hard at work at it right now, and it's I can't really go into what it's going to be. Bradley's going to be in it, but I can't tell you exactly what he's going to be doing. But what I've already said about Bradley is that I don't necessarily want him to follow in his footsteps, or if he does, I don't want to have him do it the same way his dad did. I don't want to make him a clone of Patrick McClanahan. Up to a certain point, I still want him to be a leader. I still want him to be a maverick. But Patrick McClanahan started out like that, and I want to show how Bradley becomes that, and why he becomes that, why he wants to be a leader. You know, so I want to create a lot of questions about his character, and answer some of them now in the next book, number 24, and then maybe take 5 or 10 books after that to get to know his character a little bit more and grow him a little bit, and eventually have him take over and have his little cast of characters take over, and then start developing the next generation after that. But it's a lot of fun. I'm not starting with a fully formed character like Patrick. I'm starting with a blank slate, and now since we're in the 21st century, I don't have to grow him like Patrick would have grown in the 20th century, because of technology and the way that society has been changed and formed and the way it grows now, that he doesn't have to. I mean, what he wants to do, if it's fairly close to what his dad has done, he's not going to do it the way his dad did it. And so how has technology and how has society changed to allow him to become who he wants to be without being a clone of his father? That's another thing I want to explore in book number 24.
Now, last question. And for someone who's written a character like Patrick McCallaghan so long, have you decided in your head how you're going to eventually, you know, end him in the books to where Bradley is going to be now number one taking over and readers are just going to have to know Patrick ain't coming back?
Well, I don't know if I could ever kill him off or anything like that. You know, I think as long as I'm around, he's going to be around. You know, I think everybody else, all the other characters, are going to have to suffer because of that. I think that because...
And that's life. You know what? People retire. People stop knowing what they're doing. That's just the way it works.
But also, I mean, just like I want to, you know, want to develop Bradley, I just don't want Patrick... Of course, I don't think anybody believes that Patrick McClanahan is just going to fade off into the sunset. That he'll still be active, he'll still be in the fight, but he won't be the main guy. He might be the mentor, he might be the guide, you know, he might be one of the major supporting characters, but he's never going to go away. As long as I'm writing the books, I can't say for positive, but I can pretty much guarantee that as long as I'm doing the books that he's going to be in it in some way. Now, you know, my major objective for the next 10 or 15 books is to develop Bradley and bring him along as a major player in the 21st century, whatever it is, the military, pure aviation. If I decide to continue on the Civil Air Patrol, maybe a high-tech Civil Air Patrol storyline, maybe I'll do that. But it's fun to work on these things, work around with dabbling around in the future and really taking these characters and having some fun with them.
Well, you know, it's great to hear you say 10 or 15 books, because for the next 10 or 15 Mays, we are definitely going to know that we are going to be seeing Dale Brown coming out with another great book. So, Dale, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I want to thank you so much for writing A Time for Patriots, which is out now. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, John. Thanks for having me on.
You have a great day. Enjoy the weather now.
You too. Oh, I shall.
All right, bye.
Thank you.
So, again, everybody, that was best-selling author Dale Brown, latest book, A Time for Patriots. His website is megafortress.com. You can find out all the information. Dale's books are available wherever you buy books. He's been writing them for many years. You can find them everywhere with his character, Patrick McCallaghan, in it, and now his son Bradley taking over, like you said. And the first line when you go on his website and you see For a Time to Patriots, it sets the whole thing up right away because it says, "Welcome to Battlefield America." That's kind of what you need to know right about this book, and definitely one you need to go out and have on your summer reading list to go to the beach, to go on vacation, and pick it up. And if you haven't read them before, you can go back, like he said, you know, Flight of the Old Dog back that he wrote, which was the first one. And you can just keep going forward because they're all relevant and they're all very much up to the times of what's happening. And he pushes the limits of political spy thriller in a way that, you know, makes it very emotional for the reader and has that deep connection. So we also had H.T. Nerera on, and his book was The Fun, and you can find him at htnerera.com, Narea.com, and read more about him. We're going to be coming back on the air here in about 4 hours. We are going to have author Steve Barry talking about his book, The Jefferson Key, his latest in his Cotton Malone series, his first domestic thriller with Cotton Malone. So that's very interesting. The book is fascinating because it deals with, you know, issues that are going on right now in America's past to the present, and some things in there that you might not know that actually exist here right in our Constitution. And so he takes Cotton and explains the historical aspects of what's going on and puts it in another great Cotton Malone thriller that just leaves you going from page one to the end of the book and you know, to use a cliche, you know, it leaves you breathless and it leaves you wanting Steve to bring another one back out really soon, which, you know, I'm sure he has in the works and he'll talk about that. So that's going to be in about 4 hours. We're going to have Steve Berry on to talk about that. We're also going to play a clip from Andrew Peterson's book, Forced to Kill. It's going to be in audio form. We're going to have that around 3:30. You can hear it after the Steve Berry interview, so we invite you to stick around and listen to that. And then on May 26th at 2 p.m. Pacific, we are going to have Laurel K. Hamilton on. Laurel K. Hamilton is the best-selling author of the Anita Blake series. She's on book 20 with Hitlist, along with a Marvel comic that she's doing, and a lot of things going on with Laurel K. Hamilton that we're going to get into on May 26th. So we have a lot of stuff coming up, a lot of stuff going on, and, you know, we just can't wait until the summer session comes out, because the books are starting to fire here with Gail Brown coming out. H.T. Nerera's book just came out, and, you know, there's a lot of things that are happening and going on that you're definitely not going to have any problems finding some great books that are here in the future, you know, for summer reading, because if Hollywood's not getting you, at least the authors are definitely getting you. So we invite you guys to all come back here at 3 o'clock Pacific time in about 4 hours for Steve Berry to talk about the Jefferson Key. And we'll see you all then. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you later.